You know, Mayo, I was really over the Apple Pro Display XDR, and you know, I wanted that, and then the price would always make me say no way, and then it was out of my mind. And over the weekend, I ended up in Austin, Texas, at the Apple Domain Northside store, and they had not one but two Apple Pro Display XDRs on display, and the display is just amazing. I had like a physical reaction to it.
Was one nanotextured, one glossy?
Yeah. And the one I went to, so they had a Mac Pro, which I looked at for like a few moments. And then I was kind of, you know, okay, cool. It's a computer. And then the display.
Because in the store, they don't let you like touch the Mac Pro really, right? Like, it's just, you just kind of look at it from the outside, but you can't take the lid off or anything.
Yeah. That's like the one thing I literally did was just touch it and like look under it and things. But like, yeah, I wasn't brave enough to like shut it down and detach cables and pop it open. So that was kind of it for the Mac Pro, but the XDR display, like, oh my gosh, that was, so you had two, one was attached to the MacBook Pro that I have, and then one was attached to the Mac Pro, and, they just happened to already be one in landscape and one in portrait orientation. And the one that I looked at was in portrait orientation because I was like, I've never really seen macOS in portrait orientation before. And especially on the screen. And then I noticed that the one I was looking at was in the nano texture. And then I looked at the glossy one and I was like, oh no, I've seen this one first. That one looks way worse now. And, it's amazing. I turned it from, you know, when it was in portrait mode, I put it like all the way down. So it looked like it was just coming out of the table, like this monolith thing. And just like, you know, I would never use it for like what it is, but something in the leagues of that good. With those specs, like just in terms of like being Retina and similar to that size, I would just love from Apple because it was so cool. Like it's a very well made product as you would expect.
Yeah, it's just $6,000 or $7,000 with a nanotext.
Yeah, $7,000 for the config that I wanted, and then I was kind of like joking around with our publisher, and I'm like, no, let's go in halves. And then I was thinking like even half that would be way too much for a display, like $3,500 for a screen. You can buy a computer for that, you know.
Yeah, you can literally get an iMac Pro with a great screen and the rest of the computer.
It's crazy. So, but it really was nice. I mean, not $7,000 nice to me, of course, but just to see it. And I don't think like the back of it is beautiful. Like it's, you know, it's very aggressive. And if you don't have the Mac Pro, then it's like, why does it look like this? You know, because it kind of matches the Mac Pro design. But I would never see it in my office because my monitor is like in the corner against the wall. But it was really cool to like view an entire 9to5 Mac article with comments like in one view. Or like I was looking, I wanted to see some like really good pictures. So I went to SpaceX's Flickr account and I was looking at like a full screen picture or with like exit data below it. And you could just see so much of the web that way. And in reality, what I probably just need is to like buy a monitor that can go portrait. Cause I think that was what was making me really fascinated, you know, not just the big, beautiful screen.
Yeah. I need to make a trip to like, I think London, obviously a London store will probably have it, not one of the ones on like the outskirts. I'd have to like go into like the city to see it, but I kind of want to.
Yeah, it's a treat. I mean, our publisher Seth, he was like, I don't really understand what's happening to you right now with your reaction to this thing. And I was just like, it's the most exciting thing from Apple I've seen in ages. And when I was in there, other people came in the store. There was, a mother and daughter, and, they were looking at it, and, they too are just like, this thing's gorgeous. You know, and it's just like, yep, they get it. And it also just reaffirms what I think me and you kind of landed on, which is Mac Pro, you know, out of our league in terms of needs, but the monitor, like we want Apple to make a monitor that is based on this. And, you know, just
they could make a monitor, which is like 90% as good and be like four times cheaper. Right. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Because even a $2,000 monitor, which is still expensive in the
$1,000 monitor is expensive.
Yeah. But even like a $2,000 one is like finally within reach of like us. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
we would do it.
Yes, a $2,000 monitor is really expensive. Like the monitor that I currently use was like $250. but still, like that's actually where you're getting into the remit of like, okay, you could actually pay for it and still, you know, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
The $6,000 level is just like, you know, stratospheric.
Yeah, I mean,
sure they will at some point do a non-XDR Pro display. It's just how long do we have to wait for it?
Yeah. And of course, they didn't have the trackpad out, so I didn't see that, but I did get to see the silver and black mouse and keyboard. And fingers crossed that those go on sale on their own sometime soon, because they would look really cool in my office. But yeah, that display, I was just like, oh, it gives me something new to kind of lust after in the Apple world that I haven't had for a while. So it serves a purpose for me.
I love the image of them just being like on display in normal Apple stores and regular people just walking around and like seeing them there, because, you know, if you're not like looking for the detail, you're not going to know that this one's like high quality than, you know, a display you'd see in Best Buy, right? Like,
yeah.
It obviously is much, much nicer, but from, you know, a distance glance, people aren't going to be able to tell the difference. And the Apple Store doesn't have like massive pricing cards or anything, so you can imagine someone being like, oh, okay, I'll just get this laptop and I get the screen with it, and then like the genius like checks it out and they're like, yeah, the screen's $6,000, and they're like, what?
Yeah, I think that the default cursor speed on macOS is already too slow. Like, I always turn it way up. But on this, like, gosh, it's really slow to get from one corner to the other corner. Especially,
yeah, I always have the mouse speed on, like, the highest setting.
Yeah, one of these days we're going to talk about, like, all the macOS defaults that we change, because there's so many that, you know.
And the thing that really annoys me about the cursor speed is that it doesn't remember it on the lock screen before you log in.
Oh, right? yeah.
So if you like restart the computer and you have to like move the mouse, you're like, what is going on? This is moving like glacially slowly. But no, it actually doesn't remember that setting until you actually type your password in and get into your account.
Yeah. So yeah, I tweeted a picture of Seth, our publisher, his face next to the display, because he made like a crazy face. It was like, that's his review. Although in reality, he was just like, I don't get it. Like, you could buy so much more for this price, you know. But also on Instagram, I posted like I think 4 pictures of it in a little gallery. So I was just amazed by it. And being in the portrait orientation, it was just really cool to see macOS like that. Do you know? Like, I guess the answer is yes, but macOS has just always had portrait support. And if you use a display that's just portrait, it will recognize that.
Yeah, they've had portrait support for ages. Yeah. It just, you know, it's just rare. Like the monitor I use now, its original stand that it came with, you can make it go portrait. Mm-hmm. And the with the Pro Display XDR, it will automatically switch, because it's got it's got an accelerometer in the screen, and okay, it tells macOS. Obviously, if you have like the third party ones, you have to go into the settings and just manually set the resolution.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then you probably want like a utility to make it faster. So yeah.
Cool. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense then. So maybe that's what I'm seeking out, is the silver mouse and keyboard, and then a display that I can do. Because I've got my display I use now at my desk is the LG 4K Ultrafine, the 21.5-inch model. And like technically I could upgrade to the 5K one again, but I just really don't want to go back to that. I hope that there's something better coming sometime, but probably not this year. We might have heard about it. Oh well. Let's talk about some Apple stuff. The first thing is something I posted over the weekend, which is that Apple Arcade had a takeover on Apple.com's homepage. And this is really kind of... Oh, speaking of the display, one thing I did was video the full Apple Arcade homepage takeover.
That's cool.
On Apple.com. And you could see everything all at once. So... but anyway, yeah, you wanted to talk about this, so what have you got? What have you got on this?
Yeah, so do you just want to like explain what they did?
Just yeah, so people well, yeah, it? It's just someone on Twitter tipped us to it at first, and it was like 4 a.m. I woke up, and on a Saturday morning, you know, it's like, oh, go check that out. And it was one of those things that it classifies as like totally whimsical, like it's very playful, and it was just like the standard Apple.com tiles for the iPhone 11, and you know, the same tiles you often see. The only thing omitted was that there was no Pro iPhone, but they had, you know, MacBook, all this stuff. But then, like, characters from the Apple Arcade world, like the Floor is Lava guy and Pac-Man and Sonic, would just sort of, like, appear on the screen in those tiles and, like, interact with what was happening.
And you had the guy from the Link, the Zelda clone on Apple Arcade. And they had drawn it wearing AirPods. Oceanhorn's the game. So it's the, yeah. I don't know, I can't remember the character from it. But I thought it was just like really fun. And they haven't really done anything like that I can think of, where they've like kind of remixed their own like homepage stuff. No, they have done like takeovers before where they like dominate the homepage just with one product. But that's like with marketing for that one product. And this was kind of like Easter eggs on like every billboard of the page for Apple Arcade. And it obviously took like a lot of effort. They had to make like custom videos. They had different ones for desktop and different ones for mobile. And they had cool animations like all the way through. It was really clever. But it was kind of weird in that this came out on the weekend of the Super Bowl. And I was like, oh, okay, so they're going to do a Super Bowl commercial, you know, like mark it up. But they didn't. So, yeah, so it's kind of like a... I feel like they underplayed the amount of effort they'd gone to, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah, something else they did this week is a few things. So I don't know exactly when they did this, but, you know, Apple News has had this... the integration with they're not sponsoring, but they're a part of a Democratic debate in the primary for the U.S. presidential election. And their partner is ABC, and I think it's for the New Hampshire debate. So that's coming up this month. Part of the integration is that they have a section on in the Apple News app that lets you submit a question. It's like, you tap a button and it pops up an email form and you can submit your question. So it says, have a question you'd like to ask the candidate at the Democratic debate in New Hampshire on Friday? Submit it to the ABC Newsroom moderators here. And you tap on here and it brings up an email form with like the email address already populated. And then you put your question there. And it's pretty cool because when this integration was announced or this you know Apple partnership with sponsoring the debate in some way was announced, we wondered what will Apple's contribution be? Will they just carry it through the Apple News app? Which the answer there was yes, but will they maybe field questions from Apple, like from Apple News editor in chief? And you know, in this case, they are doing that, and they're doing it through their customers. So it makes sense that Apple would want to be involved in a debate because then they can – policies that they care about as a company could be brought up as questions in the debate. But by doing this with Apple News, it helps just anyone engage with the process. So usually they've got like, you know, tweet your questions, Facebook your questions, YouTube your questions. But being able to just send an email through Apple News, for me, I've not submitted a question in this way before, largely because like a tweet would be public and that kind of thing, but an email is like
awkward.
Yeah, with an email it's like, I have questions that I think would be nice to be in the debate, let me take advantage of this. So it's a pretty cool thing. If you haven't seen it, just go to the Apple News Spotlight section of the Apple News app in the US, obviously because it's a US election, so you can't see it in the UK, Mayo.
I do think that's kind of stupid. Don't you, like, obviously they shouldn't have it on like the home tabs, but I should be able to like dig in and find it if I wanted to look at just because they have all the candidate profiles for everyone. It's like, okay, you know, more if I'm interested in actually looking at that stuff, but they just don't let you.
Yeah,
if you're not in the US.
Yeah, it's the same for like it should be in like the world news section for you where you can see it. Maybe not submit a question even, but just be exposed to it, because I would check out what's going on in your news if I could with the Apple like curated stuff, or not just curated but like, you know, their editorial stuff. Yeah, but in all, like it's. I was talking with my wife about the process so far, and like who's running and everything. And I was just curious, like, you know, do you know who's running? And besides the president for re-election, and she just, you know, knew a couple of folks, and there used to be like 20 or 30. There was way too many people, and now it's winded down to who qualifies as just a few folks. And but she didn't know, and some of the names are newer people, they're late into the race, but I was surprised at that. And so with that, and it was kind of reasonable though, like we're still months away, you know, the general election's in November, but for I think it's something that you know is reasonable to actually be to follow at this point in the process. Because if you're voting in the Democratic primary, then you can affect the outcome of at least your party. This year, there's not that competition in the Republican Party because it's the president for re-election and no one ran against him with enough steam. But so this is pretty cool. And it can be controversial that Apple does this stuff, that they get involved in this. But just as a service, what they do here is really clear, and the graphics are I mean, they're kind of funny looking when they're like making an animated version of the people, but of the candidate. But the information that they've got is pretty concise, and it's like they've got breakdowns for you will probably like this person if you like these positions, and you'll probably not like them if you don't agree with these positions. And you know, then here are the chances of being elected and stuff like that. So just as a product itself, I found that this section's pretty cool.
And, yeah, it's well made.
Yeah, and I just like to my wife, I just sent her this and I was like, check this out. You know, just look at it. It's pretty informative. So and I think if you haven't yet and you're at all curious about this, then it's neat, you know. But accepting questions for the debate is pretty cool. And I will definitely tune in on that, where I haven't every debate this year. But I wanna see, you know, how is this presented from with the Apple relationship, and do they call these Apple News questions, you know, like from readers or from users? So that'd be pretty cool. And then they've I guess this year, this week, they promoted just the Apple News section for the presidential election coverage in general as a thing. Do they do anything different this week, or is it just that they promoted it?
Yeah, I think they recapped because we talked about it before, right? They had a press release before, so they kind of recapped that. They brought it up into the news app for real this time, not just saying they were going to be part of it.
Yeah.
And then they said, like, they confirmed that there'll be like live streaming in the TV app and all of that stuff.
Yep. And they've even got a cool section, like if you can look at what they call the issues. So you've got the candidates and there's icons for the candidates, and then they've got the issues and there's icons for the issues, and it's alphabetized, so it's not like ranked by any bias. It's just alphabetized, and it's pretty informative as a resource. You know, when I speak to people who want to vote but they don't follow the news every day or read, you know, a bunch of newspapers, and they often, you know, one of the things that they do to find out who they like is like take a quiz online. And it can be, it's tricky because, like, you know, the way that the quiz is presented can not have a lot of nuance to it. But I think when you've just got like the raw information of these are the issues and these are the candidates, and it's built into the iPhone, essentially, it's like, that's pretty good access to good information that you can rely on. So I like that a lot.
If you're running your own business, just take a moment and think about all the hours you spend moving information from one program to another. Just because each app doesn't directly support the right file format or whatever silly reason there is behind it. Surely there's a more intelligent way, and that's where Zapier comes in. Zapier is the easiest way to automate your work. It connects business software so they can work together. Computers are smart, and Zapier helps you to wield that untapped power to automate common tasks, speed up your daily process, and more. Automating tasks not only makes things faster, it eliminates human error, making the output reliable and consistent, day in, day out. Just go to our special link, zapier.com/happyhour, to get started. Connect up the apps you use most and let Zapier take it from there. Zapier supports more than 1,500 business applications, so there's a nigh unlimited number of integrations that you can create. For instance, you can connect your email and your Dropbox together. When someone sends you an attachment to your business email address, have that attachment automatically saved to a folder in your Dropbox, and then Zapier can notify you through other medium that there's something new to check out. You could also do something even smarter by filtering by subject line, like if you get invoices, that can always go into a specific location, and then all other attachments can go elsewhere. Join more than 4.5 million people who are saving an average of 40 hours per month by using Zapier. Right now, through the end of the month, try Zapier for free by going to our special link, zapier.com/happyhour. That's zapier.com/happyhour for your free 14-day trial. Thanks to Zapier for supporting the show. zapier.com/happyhour.
Apple News is not just the part that people like. It's the part that lets you subscribe for $10 a month and for access to some magazines and some newspapers. And that's called News Plus. And this week, News Plus has subtracted their business leader. So what's this story?
Yeah, so Bloomberg reported that the, quote, head of business for Apple News stepped down less than a year after the launch of Apple News Plus, because Apple News Plus came out in March. And Liz Schimmel joined Apple in 2018 after having previously worked at Condé Nast right around the time of the Texture acquisition. And so, you know, clearly she had some association with the News Plus thing, and this week she is leaving the company. So, like, according to people familiar with the matter, Shamil was responsible for overseeing relationships with publishers and advertisers. So, like, the problem, right, people obviously saw this and they were like, this is a direct reaction to News Plus being bad.
Mm-hmm.
And for starters, it doesn't say anywhere that she was, like, fired for the News Plus ordeal or she was underperforming or anything like that. It just says she left the company. So, potentially, you know, News Plus didn't do as well as she thought, and so she was like, I'm going somewhere else, right? Or whether they kicked her out. It's kind of immaterial to the point, is that at the end of the day, you know, her job title is about advertiser and publisher relationships. Like, it's not exactly attuned to the problems of the Apple News Plus experience, right? Like, it's a business, it's like a business person. And in my opinion, the problem with Apple News Plus is the product. It's not like how they sold it, right? Like, it's just the product isn't compelling enough.
Well,
and get enough newspapers on board.
Unless they know that, you know, we talked before in the podcast about how there's a certain point in time that comes when the public, when the partners can leave, and they can leave in mass because a lot of them are connected to each other. So maybe it's related to that. So
that previous report said that publishers can leave after a year of being on the service if they're unhappy,
which is approaching.
So that would be March, mid-March would be the time to look out for a News Plus exodus, if there is any.
Indeed. And there's not been a bunch of News Plus additions, have there? I mean, it's you had the launch in the UK, or which is that right? The launch in the UK, and so then you have new UK-specific partners. But there's not been, like, you know, the next equivalent of the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times.
Yeah, they haven't added on, like, another big name, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, or even like on the digital subscriptions with the online websites, they haven't added any more of them. And
there's a ton of newspapers that they could add that wouldn't have to be the New York Times, and it would just fill it out with newspapers. That would be a big step. But the
content offering that you get today is basically in the US is basically the same as what you got when they released it in March.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they've done some minor updates to the app design, and you can get like easier access to back catalogs and old issues, and it's a bit simpler to follow stuff now. It's still not to what I would call, like, you know, the acceptable quality bar, but it is improved a bit from the terrible March release.
Yeah,
but like the fundamental of the app is, like, we just spent what, 10 minutes talking about all this kind of like special experience that Apple's crafted for the presidential debates.
Yeah,
and then what's News Plus? It's like lowest common denominator PDFs is ultimately what you're reading, right? Like, in 80% of cases, and then in another, you know, 18% of cases, it's in Apple News format, but the publishers don't spend any time actually making things that look cool or impressive. They're just very, very basic machine translations of PDFs. And so it's basically just like a text, a plain text and some images spattered in between. And then you've got like National Geographic that actually, you know, cares about making something look good for one issue or whatever. That's the problem with the product. It's like so lowest common denominator. It's like you can just read the web. Like, that is the fundamental issue with the News Plus product. I think the pricing is fine. I think share amongst your family, $9.99 a month. Okay. I think if the product was better, more people would be on board. Like, if you could, and also for stuff like the Wall Street Journal, if you could actually use your subscription to read on like Safari ad free, or even if you like went to that page in Safari, it could like pop up and say, you know, read this right now in news, and it'll be completely ad free and you get the nicer experience. Like, those kind of integrations just don't exist. It's like completely siloed off in its own world with terrible apps on the Mac, mediocre reading experiences. It's not about like the advertiser relationship, which is what, you know, the outgoing executive here was responsible for.
Yeah, that's right. And I always mention the podcast whether or not I'm paying for Apple News Plus or not, but right now I'm in. And I think if I canceled it, no one in the family would even notice, which is just too bad. But I like the product. I want it to get better. It hasn't yet. You know, even the small user interface changes that it's had over the last, you know, 9 months have not made it so much better. For me, it needs to be just even more partners. And you know, it's part of services, and, you know, so it's under the person who's in charge of services at Apple, you know, who ultimately goes to Eddie Q. So I think Peter Stern's the guy, and then Eddie Q, and then Tim Cook. So, that's sort of the pecking order there, but I'm not sure it should be judged in the same way as like Apple Arcade or TV Plus. Because like, and it's tricky too, because you've got newspapers and magazines mixed in, which are two very different things, but the newspaper stuff is what I'm most interested in if they could get it right, but that's the least populated part of it. And if Apple just made some special deal with like a couple of the major newspaper publishers that had tons of regional content, that the goal of it was not to make money from it, but to get local reporting in more hands, and Apple kind of foots the bill for it in a way that is just like, you know, in terms of their values, it would be good. Then I think that'd be cool too. You know, it doesn't have to be for profit, really, you know, in terms of making this a service. Cause I'm not sure that there's for Apple that the way that they pitched it is like, you know, the initial pitch of it was you go to the newsstand, you see all these magazines, but you can only buy one. What if you could buy all of them? But magazines are so specialized that like you might want two or three or zero, but you're not going to want all the magazines. No one's got that much time. So that pitch,
like, yeah. Why would I go to the news app when I can read it on the web? Like, that's the web is offering me basically the identical experience, and it's easier to get to, and everyone links to the web pages.
You see it on Twitter, you see it on Facebook, and you get to the web page because it's linked there. And yeah,
like they could incorporate into news a optional program where you could, and we've seen other, like, there's loads of like random startups that do this kind of thing where it's like you pay, you know, a monthly subscription, and the ads on the select web pages disappear. Mm-hmm. And so you're basically just funding through direct payment. They could roll something like that into News Plus and say, like, we have these partners on the web, and, you know, it could be a free sign-up process. Like, part of the problem, I think, with News Plus at the moment is it's so closed down. It's like you have to be, like, a established publication to actually have any role in this thing whatsoever, and then you have to agree to their terms. Whereas if they went to, like, random websites, the random websites have much lower costs, and they generally funded free with advertising. And what's Apple's model? They hate advertising. So here's a solution to get rid of advertising. And the third party like extensions that kind of offer this never get off the ground because you have to install this third party stuff, and it's only with, you know, 10,000 people, and so there's a massive like chicken and egg ecosystem problem. Or Apple could do it. They could integrate it directly into Safari. It would be incredibly popular. You could have all the websites sign up. You could have like 9to5 Mac sign up, and then it should be like revenue share of that. Like, I think there's so much more scope for like premium news that is way beyond, you know, like magazine PDFs. Yeah, and that could still be part of the service, but it doesn't have to be the only thing that's there.
Yeah, even in terms of the free Apple News stuff, the format, there was a pretty big cleanup recently where if you hadn't posted in, you know, 1 year or something like that, and then you had to post by a certain date or you were going to be removed, where I think it would be better if they treated news like the web, where, you know, you're there, and you're there, even if you post like once every 2 years, and encourage people of all, you know, publications of all sizes to be included, you know, like just your personal blog, even if you don't blog, you know, annually, to have it be a part of news, have it just be like a better version of the web would be all right.
Yeah, like if I could put Mayo Blog into Apple News Plus and then say, look, if you want to support me, you can just read Mayo Blog and Apple News Plus. It's just part of your subscription and I get a little kickback. Like, but they're so like old media and like, oh, it's only literal like magazines and then the Wall Street Journal that's actually like involved in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And which is like, even then I think that, it's not certain that the Wall Street Journal will stick around, you know, and be in there. So they need way more partners, and that would for me be a big deal. But
yeah, they need more partners and a better app, and probably like feed in live news or podcast news. Like, what if they had news podcasts that were ad free if you had the News Plus subscription?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big opportunity there for like news to be on the Apple TV, and for it to be videos, even like from the sources, because the sources are all doing video. You know, so if you are a News Plus subscriber, then you get access to the videos that are on the website. You know, then there's a lot of cool stuff that they could do that I would really like to see. Where right now they bought Texture and integrated, and fewer people were happy.
Badly integrated it.
Yeah, fewer people were happy
to the point where it actually annoyed Texture subscribers.
Exactly. Yeah.
And some of the reports are they currently have less subscribers than Texture did, which is not the right direction.
So that's this week in news. Let's talk about some exciting stuff, which is the release of a bunch of new software betas for developers this week. iOS 13.4, watchOS 6.2, tvOS 13.4, and macOS 10.15.4. I'm not sure if left anything out. Well, let me know if it did. And so...
Well, obviously iPadOS 13.4, because it's clearly a completely different operating system.
I will often respect that and say iPadOS, you know. And but when they've got the release notes for these, and it's like they've got a release notes for each release, and then for iOS, they see it's the same URL for iOS and iPadOS. It's like, okay, that's all right. It's the same. Some new stuff in there. There's like six or seven new Memoji stickers. So that's whenever you make a Memoji character of yourself, and this is the sticker version of that, where it's like not based on your facial recognition, like in live responses to your face, but like it's just like preset poses that the sticker does. And so they've added some more there, so that everyone that doesn't require Face ID, everyone gets those. Screen time communication limits on the Mac, and that was new on iOS, and the next, the last most recent update, and they fixed it in the last update, but it wasn't on the Mac. Now it's on the Mac. What's changed with iCloud Drive this time?
Yeah, so if you recall, in the iOS 13 betas, we had iCloud Drive folder sharing. So in similar vein to the Dropbox model, you could share a whole folder of content with someone, and then whenever stuff gets changed or new files get added, both people synchronize and they see the same stuff. That got removed because there was some pretty bad bugs during the summer beta period, which, by the way, I think people have kind of like extrapolated into the wider like poor bugginess of Apple software, but you know, it was literally just in the betas. It didn't actually ship to public customers. So I think history has kind of been transmogrified against them in a way. Like, people remember it as if it was like public software, but no, it was just like, it was the beta period, right? But anyway, there were issues. They pulled it, they delayed it. They said it was going to come in the spring, and it's, you know, approaching the spring now. Presumably iOS 13.4 will come out, you know, March, April timeframe. And so that's definitely springtime. And sure enough, the iCloud Drive photo sharing feature is back. So you can share your folders and synchronize them between people on iOS, iPad, and Mac. What's kind of interesting is that not all of the features from the iCloud Drive stuff is back. So it's kind of like a partial return of features. So one thing that was there in the summer that isn't there at the moment is like pinning. So in the summer, you could make it so that this file is never deleted from local storage, and it's always saved locally. Because like iCloud Drive does that kind of like optimized storage thing where files you don't use recently just go back and get pushed back to the cloud and reduce on-device to maximize on-device storage space. Mm-hmm. But this pin feature would let them like always stay locally. And that's still not there. And there's some like developer API stuff that's still disabled. But the core like share a folder is now available again, to at least in the betas.
Nice. I'm not running these betas. I don't know if you are yet or if you plan to, but I'm
running them on the phone and the iPad and the watch. I never run the Mac betas.
Okay. I'm doing them on nothing still. I resisted those last kind of like boring point updates, and that was good practice for this one. So this one I'm not in on yet either. But when they're officially released, I will install them. And then we can, I mean, I'm happy to go forward with using this feature because we use Dropbox now. You're the main person that I use Dropbox with on a weekly basis, and it's just for this podcast. And so then we can use iCloud Drive.
Yeah, and I am so done with Dropbox. Like,
yeah, it's kind of crazy.
I use it with like hatred every single time, and it's not even that annoying. But you can clearly see the direction of the company of Dropbox is they're moving towards focusing for enterprise and teams because they can get, you know, monthly subscriptions that are really expensive, and that's perfectly fine. But you know, that's not what I need at all. I use Dropbox with you to literally share like audio files.
Yeah, ad reads and your podcast recording.
Yeah, exactly. And all I need is a folder that syncs. I don't need any special fanciness, just a folder that syncs, and we'd be good.
Yeah.
And I do have Dropbox currently used from other stuff, like some other backup stuff. So what I'm probably going to do is, and that is kind of more critical to like, you know, my day-to-day like work, but I still would love to get rid of that as a dependency as well. Yeah. But what will probably happen is when the Mac betas turn into Mac public releases, we'll switch from Dropbox for sharing the audio files to the iCloud Drive solution, just with, you know, for a few couple of weeks, probably just copying the files to make sure that We have, you know, just in case there's random data loss problems, which I don't think there will be, but you should always proceed with caution. And then I can uninstall Dropbox and we'll be good, right?
Yeah. Because you send me the files, you could use the web if you wanted to. I use the web. I don't have it installed on anything. I just go to the website and then I download the files. But there are times where I try to like use Dropbox to share a file with somebody with like a public URL. And even that, the last two times I've tried that just with the website, it's failed for some reason. And I've got lots of free storage from the good times when they gave you free storage for like all kinds of promotional things. So I've got another storage, but it just keeps failing. And so, for that reason, I mean, I've been on iCloud Drive with the 2 terabyte plan for years now. And that's been that's where my folder, my documents folder structure is, everything, Finder, and I sync the desktops and all that stuff. So it's like the iPad is the same as the desktop and the files app. And so that part works great for me. The iCloud notes folder that we have works great. We love that.
Yeah, that's worked flawlessly since it came out with the .0s. Fantastic. We use it for the show notes. We have full history of the show notes. And when we make a new show note document for the next episode, we don't have to share the file individually. It just gets straight added to the folder and everyone sees it.
Yep.
Perfect.
So yeah, I can't remember if this came out. There's also something new in the new releases as it relates to CarPlay, which is with CarPlay and iOS 13, you've got your home screen of icons, but to the left of that is sort of this widgets view, except you can't customize what's there. It's just sort of responsive to what you're doing on your phone, and there's only so many presets that are available. When one thing is like half the screen is your map, and even though you can have Google Maps or Waze or any number of other third-party navigation apps on CarPlay, you can't use those with the navigation tile on the dashboard feature of widgets. And as of 13.4 beta, you can, once the apps update for 13.4. So like Google Maps or Waze or whichever map you use will be an option there. If you use that, then that will take over that tile, is what we understand. And then there's also some design changes there too, just in terms of like how Apple's features work. So the tiles have been like one big one on the left side and then like two or three divided on the right side. And it's like 50-50 or thirds. And I think now they're doing a thing where it's like one third, two thirds on the right side. So some more height. And they're also doing call controls. So if you were on a phone call before, it was just you tap the little sidebar of apps and you go to the phone and you've got your call controls. But with 13.4, as just running the beta, if you're on a phone call, then you get the call controls to be right there. Like if you want to hang up or meet your call or add somebody. So
somewhat annoyingly, on the beta at the moment, it's still like when a call comes in, it takes over the whole screen, and then you have to like navigate back to the dashboard. Whereas I think it might have been more sensible to have it just so that if you're on the dashboard, it just pops up in the card, right?
I agree. Yeah.
Rather than like you having to like do the jiggy and go back again.
Yeah.
But and maybe that will tie into like, fingers crossed, an iOS 14 feature where you can have a non-intrusive phone call notification on the actual phone itself,
because
that is like top of the list for like me now, really. Like that's so annoying.
But
like something along those lines. It's a cool the design tweaks they've made though are pretty nice.
They did a good job with them. There's some small things that I've wanted in CarPlay since day one of reviewing it with aftermarket hardware, which is the ability to send respond to a message with a voice memo. Like you can do that on the iPhone. And I don't use it a whole lot. I do it on the watch sometimes. Mostly I just dictate. But on CarPlay, it can be frustrating if the environment's too noisy to do dictation properly. But you could just send a voice message of like, you know, hey, cool, I'm driving, see you in 10 minutes or something. I don't know. But you can't do that. Even if you receive one, I'm not sure that it can play it. So there's small things like that. But in terms of them looking at dashboard, it's pretty cool. And after some experience being like a friend of mine recently bought a Tesla Model 3, and I was with our colleague Chance Miller. He has one. Over the weekend I was with him and his a lot, and like seeing in just a much bigger screen than a CarPlay screen, even with, you know, it's essentially like never in a single app because it's this big dashboard anyway, and like dashboard on CarPlay is like sort of their version of that, of making it less, like, it's more than just one app at a time. It's more sophisticated than that. It's just one view that shows you all this information. It still felt kind of like the Fisher-Price version of like a modern infotainment system. It's way better designed and useful and has information that you actually want and use compared to other systems. But yeah, I hope they keep going with this because they're in the right direction, especially with 13 and then now in 13.4.
This week, 9to5Mac and Happy Hour are teaming up with Charge ASAP to give away an iPhone 11. To celebrate the launch of their new portable flash charger, we're running an iPhone 11 giveaway on the site. Now, the flash charger is a USB-C power bank with up to 100 watt power delivery capability and 20,000 milliamp hour capacity. This means it can charge a 16-inch MacBook Pro, which is actively being used, running under load. It's also the world's first power bank to use Tesla graphene batteries. The graphene batteries mean that the flash charger can stay cool when charging and boasts a long life, 5-year lifespan, easily exceeding other products in its class. At 100 watt, you can easily charge multiple devices at the same time. In fact, using all three USB ports and the wireless charger, this single brick could charge four iPhones simultaneously. On the unit, you have a physical USB-C port and two USB-A ports, as well as an integrated wireless charger on the top. And it's been TSA approved, so it's safe for airline travel. Now, you can buy the flash charger with limited time early bird pricing at just $149. And the giveaway is open to readers in the United States and Canada, and you can enter until February 29th. Check out the link in the show notes if you want to enter and read full terms and conditions. Thanks to Charge ASAP and the new flash charger for sponsoring the show.
What are the changes with the TV app in this release?
Yeah, these are very, very minor. Like, the TV app needs big changes, but this isn't that. You've got like a few more dots to show where stuff can be scrolled. They've got like clearer links for each episode. So before, when you went to like a page for a show and they had like the scrolling horizontal list of episodes, if you just tap the little like thumbnail, it just starts playing. But if you tap the description or like the summary of the episode, then it takes you to another page which actually has like details just for the episode. But you'd never know that in a million years before unless you like somehow just magically knew that the description is tappable. And so now they've like added like proper button links for that kind of stuff. And it's just like they've done a few little tweaks about that around the place. And in terms of features, they finally integrated family sharing purchases into the library view. So this was really annoying. So if you're in like the app store, right, and you want to see family sharing purchases, you click on your little face and then you can click purchases and then it will say purchases from your family. Uh-huh. So you don't have to leave the application to find the apps that you've bought from other family members, right? You can just go and see that list inside of the app store.
Yeah, it's several taps away, but it's there. Yeah.
Yeah. With TV, you had to go to the iTunes store app before.
Yeah.
So you'd have to leave the TV app, go to the iTunes store app, find the purchases, find the family purchases, download the thing that you wanted to download, then you have to go back to the TV app to watch it because it would be stored in the library in the TV app.
Yeah.
And that was just like ridiculous. But it's been like that for ever since the TV app came out, which was 2016. So 4 years now, it's worked like that. Finally, in 13.4, they have a family sharing tab in the library view of the actual TV app, and you can click on that directly, and it shows your family members, and then you can see the content that's under their accounts, and you can watch it directly.
Yeah, I haven't seen if this is any different on the Apple TV, but that would also be very welcome. In our family, we do family sharing for everything, and we resist doing it with movies and TV shows because it's so hard to find. Like, we just want one library and it's so hard to find who bought what movie if it wasn't my account. So for that reason, like, I've got stuff in my library that I would never really want to see in there, but because of the way it was designed before, that was the easiest way. Now going forward, I'll feel a lot more encouraged to say, yeah, if you want to buy that, go and buy it. I mean, it's the same bank account, but I want it to come from your account so I don't have to see it all the time unless I want to see it easily. So I like this.
And I don't know if it's just placebo, but I feel like the screens load a bit quicker as well.
Okay.
I could be making it up, but I used to get really annoyed. Like, you click on like an Apple TV Plus show and you'd wait for ages before the the page would fully load with a background image, and it seems like it's a bit faster. So maybe they've done some like under the hood performance tuning as well, which is always appreciated.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be good. The Photos app finally has something I've wanted for a long time, which is support for keyboard shortcuts. So if you're using a smart keyboard or Bluetooth keyboard, then you can do things like what you can navigate, you can enter edit mode, you can delete pictures, just basic things that you come to learn from the Mac. And then the Photos app on the Mac looks a lot like the Photos app on the iPad. And then the keyboard was just kind of useless there. And that's driven me crazy, because just like navigation's like on the iPad, it's fine if you're just using that pad, but if you had a keyboard, you can be very efficient at the keyboard with navigating, you know, going in and out of pictures and full screen in the grid view, doing things like going in to edit, deleting pictures, like just kind of curating your library down. And so I am so happy that it's in a 13.4 and not like 14 or 15 or some other version of iPad OS in this case. So that's very cool. And then there's now support for hardware keyboard mapping, like you can always do on the Mac. Now you can assign keys on a keyboard to be recognized as something else, like caps lock.
So you can like escape. Change caps lock, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, to escape, things like that. So that's cool. That's nice. Especially for an update like this, it's just nice thing to throw in there.
And then on the developer side for keyboards, they have finally added APIs which let apps get notified of key down and key up events. And this has like a lot of potential uses across applications. For instance, games. Say if you have a like a space bar where you have to jump, right? And when you're playing a game, you want the action to happen when you press space down, not when you lift space up. Yeah,
I see,
you
yeah,
instantly. Yeah. And so the only APIs that officially developers could use before 13.4 was something called UI key command. And that would be, you'd basically register what keyboard shortcut you want, and the system would send the event to you. And it would only send the action after you'd lifted all your fingers. So essentially after key up. There was no way for you to get a key down event. So if you just press the A key, the app would not have no way to know that you'd done that. And so in 13.4, they've expanded the APIs, and so now the apps can get separate key down and key up events and respond together. So it means you can do stuff like hold down A, and the app could do something for the duration of you holding down the button, and then stop when you release.
Yeah, nice.
That kind of thing was impossible before, because you would only get the event as your finger came off the key. And as well as this having a lot of potential for, you know, more richer iPad experiences, it also helps Catalyst on the Mac. Because if you want to, at the moment, if you're trying to do, like, write a game, you'd have to, like, do some crazy hacks to get this stuff to work, like pressing right to actually go right when you immediately press the key.
Mm.
And now they've, like, formalized it into a proper API. So the same code that you write for iOS works on the Mac to get, you know, key down and key up keyboard shortcuts. And some of the keys that were previously unavailable, there were some, like, weird, like, keys that you'd find on a Mac keyboard that you wouldn't find on an iPad keyboard, that they were just not in the list of like things you could register an event for.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can actually control those as developers.
So this could be an example of Catalyst having an effect where, because it wasn't on Catalyst as of the you know Mac Catalyst, it needs to be there. So they've got to build it into the iPad to get it to Mac Catalyst. And so Catalyst could be having a positive effect on maturing iPad OS.
Yeah, like there's definitely a symbiotic relationship there. And it shows that, you know, there's a lot of complaints at the moment about Catalyst, and one of the problems was keyboard events, and now they've actually addressed that.
Mm-hmm.
Bit out of cycle, which is nice to see. Because do you remember that game? Was it Asphalt or something? And they like made a big deal uh-huh. about it in the press release. They
racing were
like,
game.
Yeah, the racing game's going to come out, and it's going to be made with Catalyst, and then it didn't come out in fall, and then it finally came out in like January, and it was really bad. And like every time you pressed a key, it made this stupid noise because it was just running on hack after hack after hack. Like all of that stuff can be way more streamlined now. They've actually got like proper keyboard event APIs.
Yeah, so this could come from feedback from that experience that didn't go as planned.
Yeah, yeah, like a pro workflow team. Like, you know, we actually try to make the game that you wanted us to make, and it just, you know, it was terrible.
Yeah.
So this is really exciting, and there's definitely scope for some productivity apps on the iPad to do clever stuff that you could just couldn't do before, like single letter keyboard shortcuts that can immediately happen as soon as you like press a key and just make it a lot quicker to like zoom around in interface. Like that's not built in. You have to kind of like build on top of just the raw key events, but there's definitely scope for third party apps to, you know, be more adventurous now and make it more capable, like you're editing a Mac. I'm thinking of something like Ferrite. So you could do like a cut, you know, cut clips out of a podcast timeline much more efficiently with, you know, key down events and holding and long press and that, all of that stuff that you just couldn't do before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I press control on the Mac to mute and then I release it when I want to unmute. So that's...
Yeah, like press to talk was
impossible
to implement on iOS before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. And what's new with Shazam as it relates to shortcuts?
You can, there's a Shazam action in the actions library of shortcuts. So you can make a workflow which listens to the microphone and gets the song. It runs the song detection, and then you can obviously process that in the workflow. And you can do that even without having to have the Shazam app installed.
Oh, nice.
So maybe there's some, because obviously iOS has always let you Shazam through Siri, but you know, you're in the Siri UI, you can't actually like do much with the result apart from play the song, right? It like names it and you can like add it to your music library. If you are, you know, an enterprising shortcut developer or shortcut maker, you could put the Shazam action in there and like have it automatically add it to your reminders, right? Or something, you know, do something clever like that, or like automatically or message it to someone else. Like you could, you know, you're getting it as data and it gives you the title and it gives you the URL and you can do whatever you want with it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And then in-app purchases will now be a thing as of watchOS 6.2. So you can do things on Apple Watch. Like you've been able to use Apple Pay in watchOS apps like you can on the iPhone. Like you can add money to your Starbucks rewards card, but you couldn't do like an in-app purchase. And so in the age of standalone watchOS apps, you couldn't have like a free app and then to unlock the full version, have an in-app purchase for that, or, you know, give a tip or a subscription or something like that. So now you would be able to make that in-app purchase be a thing, which is good for the health, you know, having a healthy app platform, you know, be a thing.
And especially for standalone watch apps, right? Because previously, if you had a Apple Watch app, you always had an iPhone app to go along with it. And so if a developer wanted to monetize the watch app, they tell you to just buy the in-app purchase through the iPhone app and it would just like, you know, sync with the watch eventually. And that's kind of what I do with like Daily Dictionary, right? You can buy the subscription in the iPhone app and then the watch app gets some extra features as well. What Apple made a big deal about with watchOS 6 was the ability to make independent watch apps that are only, that can stand alone. You can download them on the watch themselves and they don't require a companion phone app to be installed at the same time. But that was a big problem for monetization because you couldn't sell in-app purchases on the watch standalone, and now you can. 6.2.
Yep. And then compact date picker, this releases a Catalyst as well.
Yeah. So another thing which is like a classic, a very easy target to like criticize Catalyst is like you go into the home app, you change the schedule for an automation, and you pick time of day, and there's just a iOS date picker with the reels for the hour and the minute, and you can't flick it, you can't use natural like direct interaction because there's no touchscreen, so you have to like roll your mouse up and down to change the date. It's like terrible, and everyone's complained about this from left, right, Sunday, and clearly there must be a better way of making a date picker because we've seen it on the Mac for years where you just have like a little text box which has the hour and the minute and you can type a number in. I know, incredible technology. And what they've done in 13.4 is at least listen to that feedback and offered a bit more support to make it easier to make a more Mac native date picker UI. And so the date picker control in UIKit now has two modes. It can either be in the wheels mode, which looks like what you know, you've always known, or it can be in a compact mode, which looks basically like the text field date picker that you see on the Mac. It's good that they've added that. But as you'll see in the current beta of the home app, just adding a different way to lay out the control isn't enough to actually make it feel like native on the Mac. The screenshot of what the home app now looks like in 10.15.4 is better than, I guess, than Reels, but you can still tell that there's been no actual like human attention taken to the screen. It's just all like automatic framework translation, right? And it still looks terrible. So it just shows that you can't fix everything just with like magic transformations of controls from one platform to another. You do still have to have like developers go in there, do the work to actually make it look proper on every single device.
Yeah.
And at least over beta one, Apple hasn't done that with their own app.
Which in the home app, Apple could do that, right? They could make it look better. It just might not be something that they offer for all Catalyst apps or easily offered. Anybody can do their own custom stuff with their Catalyst app, but I guess they're dogfooding too much in that case where they don't want
to. Or what might have happened is that the team that works on the controls for UIKit were like, okay, we need to make a date picker version that's compact, but like the people that actually make the home app haven't actually used the API yet, and it's just doing like the automatic thing.
Yeah. That makes sense. And then the absolute biggest change in iOS 13.4 that will affect the most people is a brand new, completely rethought, out of the box mail toolbar. What's changed here?
Finally, they listened to the swarm of complaints. The classic iOS 13 mail toolbar, where they put the reply button and the delete button right next to each other, right aligned, and then had a massive swath of blank space on the left, is finally no more. They've basically gone back to the iOS 12 layout, where you had four separate buttons, one that does delete, one that does move message to another inbox, one that does flag, and then you have the kind of reply button, but that's like a catch-all for everything else that you can do with a message.
Which is still weird, but...
Yeah, which is still weird, but what was funny is when I tweeted about this, and I was like, this is so great, people are like, yeah, but the reply button doesn't actually go straight to reply, it still does this random like list of stuff. If you actually think, iOS 12 did the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. When you pressed the reply button on iOS 12 mail, it would show you reply, forward, print, and then reply all.
I don't think just 12 either, right? Like, it's been that way always?
Yeah, it's been that way for years, right?
Yeah.
But for some reason in people's heads, the mail toolbar was so bad, it had, like, rewritten the memory of how bad it is.
Yeah, and the redesign of the share sheet is like, now in the mail app, there are more things that you can do. It looks different, and other mail apps, but like that aren't Apple Mail, have share sheets, like dedicated share sheet buttons with share sheet extensions.
Yeah,
and we haven't seen Apple take that approach. We're like, let's just use the share sheet like we have in every other app. Have the reply button be reply, and have actions and extensions be in a share sheet.
Yeah, I kind of feel like they should have five buttons in the toolbar.
Yes,
they should have trash, move, flag, share, and then reply on its own on the right. And reply only replies.
Yeah.
And then you have the share button, which is the drunk drawer for everything else.
I think there's also a difference I use iCloud Mail most of the time, and I use Apple Mail on everything. I think flag also has a difference where, like, I think on one version, on one platform, it's like flags are flags, and on the other, like, they're like circles. And even if they're the same color, they don't sync up. It's like a distinguished thing. I don't know. I've just found confusion when using flags too.
Yeah.
But this is absolutely, I mean, a seriously big change that they've listened to feedback. They've, for whatever reason, they made that change through all the betas and public versions. They decided this time to change it. But you would see like just normal users who are not super into this stuff be like, why do they do this? This is very bad. I'm deleting messages now on accident.
Yeah, because it would look stupid because you had all this unused empty space. And then the reply button and the delete button were literally like next to each other, so you could easily tap the wrong one. And there's quite a big difference between the reply button and the destructive send to the trash button.
Yes, there is. And I've seen some people frame it as like not the new iPhone update, but their new iPhone, because this is all you get on the iPhone 11 family of phones is iOS 13. So if you come from iOS 12 on your old iPhone to iOS 13 on your new iPhone, it's like the new iPhone messed up my mail app. So this can't come soon enough. It's in beta for now, but I imagine we'll see these like maybe end of March or so, since we're in the beginning of February now. So that
around that time frame, I guess. Yeah. Like, I wish someone would tell me the backstory of how the mail toolbar shipped like this, because surely it has to have a good story behind it. Because like, you know, Apple is made up of incredibly smart people and incredibly good designers on the most part that make incredibly great work, and you know, 99% of the people in that company would surely agree that the iOS 13.0 mail toolbar was bad.
Well, maybe it's just like there's data to go behind it that made sense, even though the data was wrong. Maybe it's like
a data-driven company.
Yeah, maybe it's like people all like we have these four buttons, and delete and reply, which is a catch-all for everything else, is what gets used the most, and like and nobody moves messages enough, and nobody flags, and you can do those through gestures anyway. So let's just get those out of here. Now that would have been a little bit better if they would have kept the space in between, but they didn't do that. They put
like, are you seriously telling me if you got Craig Federighi like pinned against a wall and like, tell me the truth, not the PR speak, is this a good design? There's no way he would say yes it is. Like, come on.
Yeah, yeah. So there's still an opportunity for there to be like a share sheet and not the reply button being catch-all.
Yeah.
But this is a positive change for iOS 13.
Yeah, and iOS 13 has kind of been like a bookmark for me by like three big things that like they just did wrong and should just revert. And one of them was the cut, copy, and paste stuff, which only lasted between 0.0 and 0.1. So that was good. That was where like the three-finger gesture would conflict with playing games and all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So they corrected that. And then the mail toolbar was one of these things. And then the third one was removing the magnifying glass in text selection. Sadly, that one's still standing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still harder to use now without it for no
reason. Yeah, so fingers crossed for like another text selection overhaul with iOS 14 at this point. It's probably what we're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, it's rough.
Yeah.
It's rough out there.
Yeah. And then also a couple more things for this release this week. There's a new car key feature that's in the code, and it seems to be, you know, you can't use it yet. It's just a little beta version, but it's in the code, and it seems to be not like one of those things where it's in the works, but it's ready to go. And what this is it lets you use your iPhone or Apple Watch with NFC to work as your car key in cars that support that. I know like Tesla drivers can use their iPhones to unlock the car and turn it on and everything. There's lots of remote features like that, but this is an iOS.
Yeah, the Tesla app uses Bluetooth.
Yeah, Bluetooth. And this is like an iOS integrated, like first party feature that cars can then work with. And it's pretty interesting because it's like built into the iOS, and then it works with unlocking your car, locking your car, driving your car, like turning it on, and then you can even share the keys like virtually with people that you would also.
Yeah, you can like airdrop them to the rest of your family.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. So this is interesting.
Apple Car confirmed.
Well, I mean, there's so much that like CarPlay can do that hasn't been implemented, but it's supported by Apple. This kind of reminds me of that. It's like maybe there will be one car that does this, or maybe there'll be a few. But something I've been thinking about lately is that there's not one car that gives you everything that CarPlay can do, like even all the Siri stuff or all the app controls through the CarPlay screen UI. And this reminds me of that. I was like, you know, obviously at this point, Apple hasn't even announced it yet. We discovered it, but they're not advertising it yet or listing it as a feature. So, but at some point when it is official, will they have cars ready to go that have NFC and that will just work with this? Or, you know, how will this go? And it's one of those things where it's a cool thing, but I'm not sure that we'll see it be popular.
Yeah, one, obviously we're just like working off like code findings here, but it seemed like there's at least a process where you can just take any current NFC key fob and you like place it on the iPhone and it like copies the code off of it and then it just uses that.
Yeah. And I don't
know. So that would actually work with existing cars.
Yeah, I don't know how popular NFC key tags are. Like, I don't know if my car uses that.
Yeah. That is a fair point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got no clue, but it's like maybe my car uses it, but I'd have to look it up and see.
Yeah, I feel like most car key fobs are like radio frequencies, right? Because you can just like hold them in your pocket and then just open the door.
That's right.
You don't have to hold up it to like the side of the car.
That's what my car is like. So I doubt that it's NFC. So I don't know how NFC is used in cars, but. This is a thing that's happening at some point, it seems like.
And it will work with the Apple Watch as well.
Yeah, with the Apple Watch as well, which is just one, you know, one more cool thing to do. I'm at a point right now where the only key on my key ring is for my car, and it's not like a key, it's just the key fob, the remote, and if I have to have the fob part for the car to start. But for the house, we've got a keyless lock with a keypad and then HomeKit. And there's no need for another car anytime soon. So, or another key anytime soon. So it's kind of cool to have just like a I've got like a space shuttle and then the key fob, and that's it, and no actual keys there. So it feels like the future. And then finally in the update section, there's now a change coming for developers sort of as it relates to Catalyst, but not necessarily Catalyst, I believe, where now developers will be able to sell one app that works on the Mac and iOS.
Yeah. This is actually really cool. So as it stands today, the Mac App Store and the iOS App Store are like completely separated. So when you buy something on the App Store, it makes no difference to your purchase history on the Mac App Store and vice versa. And what they say they're going to introduce, they actually say March 2020 on this. So apparently all the stuff's coming out next month. A developer will be able to opt in to pair their iOS app and their Mac app purchase transactions together. So when you buy a Mac app, it counts you as buying the iOS app. And this would also apply to in-app purchases. So if you buy the in-app purchase in the Mac app, it would unlock the in-app purchase on the phone or the iPad app as well. And some of these behaviors can be kind of like jerry-rigged together today by like making you sign up for an account and then you log in with like your account in both places. But the underlying like iTunes store, you've purchased this thing, is currently siloed between iOS and Mac.
So an example of this is I use the Calorie app for calorie tracking, and they have a Mac Catalyst app, which is the iPad version on the Mac. And on iOS, the iPhone and iPad, you can be a subscriber or a lifetime member and unlock all the pro features. And on the Mac, you have to also unlock those there too, even if you're like a lifetime person. So in this case, now once this is available, then it's just one purchase or one subscription, and it works across the board, right?
If the developer wanted to do that.
Okay, yeah.
They can continue to be as they are today if they want to. And this can work with normal Mac apps, or it can work with Catalyst apps. And obviously, it's probably being done with Catalyst in mind, because I think the idea there is it's like, you know, your primary app is the iPhone app and the iPad app, but with a little bit of extra work, you can get the Mac app running. But is it really fair to charge again for the Mac app version when it's basically just, especially for the people that are just doing like direct ports on Catalyst, sure, where it's basically just the iPad app running in a window? And so up to now, there was no way for a developer to opt in to say, yes, just let them have their Mac app for free if they bought the iPhone app. And now the unified purchasing stuff will allow them to do that. And so I have a Binger machine, which has a Catalyst version, and I did like a lazy Catalyst port, and I would happily just bundle that into the price of the iPhone and the iPad version. So I'll probably adopt this. There is a kind of migration issue for existing apps, because it requires changing, like, you can't just take your existing app that's on the store and then just link it to the phone. You have to, like, make a new record, so you'd have to remove the current Mac app and add a new one, which then matched the bundle identifier of the iPhone app. So it's kind of hard to think of a good way to transition existing customers, because let's say you had a $5 Mac app before, and now you just want to make it part of your overall $10 purchase of the iPhone app. So you're going to have to add a new Mac app to the store, but the people that already paid the $5 for the old version are going to be cut off, because it's going to be basically like releasing a new version of the app.
Yeah, I think Carrot Weather is in this boat, where it was a paid app on the Mac just to, you know, to begin with. They used Mac Catalyst to get it on the Mac, but to use it, you needed to buy it. And it didn't matter. You know, obviously, they couldn't look at if you use the iPad version if they wanted to. And in this case, if they did want to tie them together, as you're saying, they need to make a new Mac Catalyst listing in the App Store, and then users would need to go and get that and remove the old one. And then if they like ignored the old one and they just push you to the new one, then the old one would not get any more updates. It's tricky. There's not a clean migration here.
Yeah, which is a shame that Apple didn't have a solution.
But luckily, it's early enough days for Mac Catalyst, and it's been adopted so little that you can probably count the number of apps affected, you know, in your head.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, actually. Like, the number of apps that are under that or in that boat is quite small. So, and this whole feature existing, there's been a lot of like scaremongering, I think, around the community this week of, oh, we're just going to have another site of devaluing the Mac apps and it's going to be another race to the bottom. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. Like, it's not required.
Yeah.
It's not required. And I don't think it's going to suddenly reverse the course of every app moving to subscription. That's still going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You just might now have it so you don't have to have two separate subscriptions.
Mm-hmm. Which is good.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah. Like, one of the low-hanging fruits with just in-app purchases and how apps are funded in general is that in-app purchases don't apply to family sharing. So if an app used to be paid and it goes to in-app purchase, then it stops being compatible with family sharing in that way. And, you know, so that's like something that they could address at some point. But this is...
Yeah, because they do it for their own services.
Right. But this, and this because it's tied to your account, I guess. And that's probably the solution for mobile is, or for iOS, is to be like, you know, tied to an account, and then it won't be. But that's low-hanging fruit. So is this. And it's nice that they did it at mid-cycle and not wait until June to show it and September or November to release it.
Yeah, and luckily for me, because I basically just did like a quick lazy port of Bing a Machine to the Mac, I just released it for free. And so I don't really have the problem of supporting existing people that paid for it, because I can just re-release Bing a Machine as Unified and just cut off the old one and be like, sorry, like, just go re-download it, because you didn't pay for it in the first place.
Yep. And then also new in the App Store is that there have been categories on the Mac App Store as part of like Mac App Store 2.0 for developer tools and graphics and design, because I guess they looked at the App Store, the Mac App Store, and they said these are what's popular in the Mac App Store, and so they made those categories, and those are now coming to iOS, and then also categories that were on iOS before: books, food and drinks, magazines and newspapers, navigation and shopping. Those will now come to the Mac App Store, so that there's consistency across iOS, Mac App Store, you know, together.
Yeah, so there will be now a developer tools category on the iOS App Store. Yeah.
Which
is cool, because there are some, you know, developer-ish apps that already are on the App Store and they could do with a better categorization. In no way does that have any indication of whether or not, like, Xcode for the iPad's on its way.
Yeah, these just used to be in productivity or utilities or something like that, and now they can be more specific. Yeah.
They're happy to do this because they want to unify things together.
So yeah, it's a requirement.
Categories are both cases.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah, cool. Nice. Anything else on this? And this is part of Xcode 11.4 beta, and so it's not available yet. But like you mentioned, it's later in March it'll be a thing. And so,
yeah, we said iOS and Mac, but obviously it also applies to watch TV and all of them together. Because theoretically, you could sell an independent watch app and an iPhone app and a Mac app and a TV app, and buying them what in one time could unlock all four.
Yeah, and even, I mean, it's not even just purchases, right? Like, it's if it's a free app, then it could be if you are a fan of using the feature where you can download the app on your iPhone and it appears on your iPad as well. That also works on the Apple TV, I believe. So then you could now have that work on the Mac, where you buy something on your, or you download something for free on your iPhone, and it's, if it's got an app for another platform, it can go to all the platforms.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Like, it's not just about unlocking, you know, in-app purchases and like the record that you bought it. Mm-hmm. It's just the fact that the App Store will now know that you own this thing on a different platform. Do you want to download it on this platform? Mm-hmm. So they could, because they have automatic downloads on the Mac, right? For
other Macs.
Now it's, for other Macs, but now I think it would work.
Me too. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, so if you download the iPhone version, you kind of automatically download the Mac version,
which can be a good way to, you know, let it be known that there is a Mac version.
Yeah, that is actually really, if they've actually tied it, made all the ends meet, so that works. That's really impactful.
Yeah, download. You said Bingo Machine is the app that you have that works. So download Bingo Machine from the iPhone and have it appear in your iPad and your Mac at the same time.
And yeah, that'd actually be pretty cool.
Oh, what's this new app I've got? Yep. And then lastly, there's a few things around Apple TV. In terms of hardware, we've seen code or at least ideas since last September that there's been likely a new Apple TV in terms of hardware coming soon. Whether it's replacing the low end or the high end Apple TV, we don't know. This week, there's some more information about that seems like it's probably getting closer, because tvOS 13.4 has new code that recognizes it, and it probably has more modern chips. So there's definitely some new things that we can expect there. So maybe if there is a spring event, then maybe we see an Apple TV with an A12 or A13 chip, and that would replace the A10. chip. So that,
and hopefully the AA Apple TV.
Yeah, man, there's a lot to talk about there. And then lastly, the Apple TV app has now come to LG TVs that were introduced in 2019. There's still more to add. So 2018 models don't have it yet, but that'll come next. It's sort of like whenever Samsung did their TV app rollout, they went from the highest end models to the lowest end models, and it took months, but they eventually got there. So in this case, they're going from 2019 to 2018, but more places with the TV app. So that's awesome.
Yeah. I'll just say one thing about the hardware situation. There are a few, like, you know, snarky joke comments where it's like, we don't need the Apple TV to have an even faster processor. We need it to be cheaper. And, you know, in your head, newer processor is more expensive than older processor, right? So they're going in the wrong direction. I promise you, the margins on the Apple TV are plenty big enough for them to be able to upgrade the hardware and make it cheaper if they want to.
Yeah.
They are not like strapped for cash here. They have plenty of room between zero and $150 to fit in an A13 chip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They could have the 4K Apple TV with an A13 chip and sell it for $99. I have no doubts in my mind they could do that and still make a profit on, you know, still make a healthy profit on it. Like, look at an iPod Touch, right? It has a screen, has all this other stuff in it. And they can, and it's regularly discounted like $120. Like, and that runs on an A10 chip. The Apple TV is literally an A12 chip in a box and a remote.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's all it is, right? If there was evidence that the remote wasn't changing, I could understand people getting all antsy about it because, you know, the remote isn't perfect. I kind of like the remote, but it's not perfect. And it would be nice if they do update it. But this, the fact that it's going to have an A12 or an A13 chip or maybe some variant of it has no ramification on the final product pricing. It's just whatever Apple decides in their head, how much are we going to overcharge for this? That's the factor, and you won't find the answer to that in code.
That's right. Yeah. I wasn't going to mention it, but I've been spending time with Fire TV sticks and then the Amazon Fire TV Cube, which is the one with built-in Alexa, and then it's got its own remote with voice control. And, you know, just by having this in all the different rooms is, I don't like the Fire TV UI, and there's a lot to complain about there. And if it was tvOS with the same like dongle hardware or box with built-in voice control hardware with Siri instead, I'd love it. But the remote itself is perfectly fine. You've got voice control and you've got a D-pad, and there's just no thought about it. And it's thick enough. Like, it doesn't use a rechargeable battery. I think you put the batteries in the back of it, like AA's or AAA's. Apple could do a nicer version of this and I'd be fine. Like, just having voice control in the remote is the main thing that I care about. And it's too bad that it's either got to be the Siri remote with these issues or your iPhone. There's no like middle ground of like just an IR remote with voice control with Siri.
Would you prefer a remote with the mic or like the hardware with the mic? Because the Amazon Fire TV Cube
hardware with the mic. Yeah.
It puts the mic in the actual box.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice. And it's not perfect. Like, I'm not sure I'd recommend it, but for me, it's just to try it out and form an opinion. Because even it's sort of like the TV app, on the Apple TV, how it has integration with some stuff, but not everything. It's like, yeah, it's the voice control stuff on the Fire TV Cube. It has a lot of control, including navigation and turning your TV on and off and changing your volume, even if you don't have like an AirPlay 2 receiver or something like that. Like, it's amazing. You can even change your volume from the Fire TV remote app on your iPhone because it's plugged in and it connects to HDMI CEC. But yeah, definitely if it was like remote or the box, the remote is just because it's not in the box, and the remote, or, you know, having it in the box is great because even if you don't have the remote next to you, you just say it in the air and it happens. So if it was just Siri on the HomePod, Siri on the iPhone nearby with Hey and Siri turned on, then and you could just acknowledge the TV to do anything, like turn it on or off, change the input, change the volume, change the content, that would be wonderful. And I would value that more than the remote, because then I can use whatever remote and I don't care.
Yeah, because one option for them is they make like a dumb box that just has a microphone in it, and then the remote they ship is the like could just be like a plain Bluetooth remote that doesn't have any smarts in it whatsoever. That's probably a better way to get costs down than keeping an A10 chip around, for instance.
Yeah,
if they really wanted to be stingy about it.
Yeah, and the Fire TV remote app does have what I think that you'd like from the, I think you've requested this for a while, from the Apple TV remote app, which is like a virtual representation of your home screen. Like,
yes, yeah.
Not just navigation. So
you can like just click buttons on the phone.
Tap the YouTube app on the remote app and it launches.
How incredible. Who could have thought about a direct one-to-one UI?
Yeah, you miss out.
If only there was a company that kind of like inspired this entire touchscreen revolution around 2007 and they worked out that direct interaction is a really good model of how to do it.
Yeah, it's... I mean, there are some things that you've got to deal with, like having a remote with double A's or triple A's in it, which is not as nice as a rechargeable remote. There's the launch screen is like they've got a black launch screen, then a really bright white launch screen, which is just horrible. Why would you put that on a TV? It blinds you in any environment. And then there's also, you know, all the Amazon service promotions and ads and stuff for content.
Because Apple has none of them. Yeah. Like, I love the tvOS experience, but it's not worth 5, 6, sometimes like 8 times the price of the really cheap like Fire TV sticks.
That's right. Yeah, I paid $99 for the Cube, and for the Fire TV stick, it was $35. So
yeah,
those are sales prices, but they're very common versus whatever they charge these days for an Apple TV.
$149 for the 2015 model, $179 for the 2017 model with 32 gigs, or $199 for the 2017 model with 64 gigs of storage.
Yeah. Right now, the...
Really charitable pricing, everybody.
Yeah. Right now, the Apple TV 4K is just not connected to anything at all. So, and again, it's not like a big decision I've made. It's just like, this is what I'm testing right now. But part of the test is like, see if the family has any complaints. And so far, they're as happy as I am. So, and they care less
about... I've been sitting on 2015 Apple TVs for ages now, and I refuse to pay the price for a 4K one.
Yeah,
and so and my family, sitting it out.
They care a lot less than I do about like the sponsored stuff and, you know, the white launch screen and all that.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's just me in the house that cares about that. So, yep. All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. One thing I want to ask listeners about in terms of interest is, I guess, two things. The first is the idea of this podcast being a weekly live broadcast. So just tweet at, you know, I don't know if you want to hear anything, Mayo, but tweet at me at Apollo Zach if that's something that you like, or email
us. You can
us.
Always tweet me.
Yeah, BZAMayo. And you can also email us together at happyhour@identifiedmac.com. And we just kind of want to gauge the interest in this being a weekly live podcast. It would probably be broadcast every week at Thursday around 5 p.m. Eastern time, or 4 p.m. Eastern time, depending on our schedule that week. But and then come out.
Yeah, and we still release the show, obviously, after it would just be recorded live.
Yeah, just come out on Fridays as usual. And then the other thing is I've often wanted to do this, but I just want to make sure it's worth the kind of the effort. But usually we go to I go to WWDC not for the conference, but for the community that week. And I would love to do a live podcast where people come, but I want to make sure people will come. And, you know, make sure it's worth putting an event together for it. So if you plan to go to WWDC this year in San Jose, California, and you think that you'd be willing to pay like, you know, $20 or $30 for a ticket to come see the podcast live, because, you know, you can't give it away or everybody will just say they're going to come and won't. But you'd want to do that, then, let us know either on Twitter or through email, and, we'll take those into consideration. And as usual, if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. If you are a longtime subscriber and listener, give us a rating or a recommendation in Apple Podcast or Overcast or Spotify. And, as always, if you really enjoy the show, share it with someone that you know who you think would be interested in listening, because we love to see, new, you know, our audience grow. So thanks everybody. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye bye.